So from the lecture before the test a week ago today, the Twitter card question was, that was the sort of synthesis of human factors, and this is one of those where I might not read the Twitter card responses because it's been a week since we had that class. But these were really good, and the Twitter card question was, can you identify an environment that you've experienced that seems to be very strong in terms of human factors? Does it really encourage a healthy, nurturing, supportive life for the people who are inhabiting that building and using that building? And we had looked at some buildings in class that were very good comprehensively in these issues of human factors. These were really good, and I was really super pleased at the fact that so many of them were about buildings on the campus that you looked at and said, you know, this building on my campus that I use is actually really supporting my life on this campus pretty well. So there were some good answers that way. Here are a few of those responses. Someone says, I think the Whole Foods store downtown here in Austin is a great example of a building that takes the human experience into consideration. Starting with the parking garage, the building is able to use new technology to help cars find a space. The escalators include an easy method for shopping carts to move up and down, and various tables are scattered around the area with food for an upbeat social experience. Now, this is a company who understands the power of architecture to make their company successful. And Whole Foods really thinks of the user experience, the human experience in their stores. And honestly, their prices are a lot higher. And their food is great, but a lot of it is, that's a positive user experience. And these days, that's my grocery store that I go to all the time. And the biggest bummer on going to Randall's or HEB or something like that is that, it's just not as pleasant to shop here. And I think that's, again, kind of unconscious, but people say, whoa, I'm going to go to the Whole Foods. I'll have a positive experience. It'll make me feel like I'm part of a community here, which is great. Somebody else says, I think the SAC handles human factors well. The building shape encourages people to walk through the building. There are many places where students can work together and collaborate. This is very important to students at UT. Having somewhere to collaborate and work together can lead to better successes for students. Someone else says, the Dell Gates complex, in my opinion, does a phenomenal job of incorporating human factors to allow for easy use and interpersonal interaction. The giant atrium, complete with a cafe and a number of study pods and couches, allows space for studying. On each floor of the building, there are group tables and whiteboards that you have to pass before walking into an actual classroom, encouraging students to interact with each other even on the way to class. Someone else says, the FAC is a building on campus that I would say encourages collaboration. The main floor is completely open so that you can see everything and everyone. Also, tables and chairs are all arranged in groups so that no one sits or studies alone. It's a great place to work on projects, and you're bound to see someone you know. I think human factors in a building are some of the most important aspects to consider. Someone else says, a place that has success with human factors is a building like the CLA on campus, College of Liberal Arts. I don't see people who are just liberal arts majors there, but students from all disciplines. It has all these hidden, cozy spaces to work, along with a great outdoor patio, so you don't feel too confined. The skylight that connects it to the SAC also makes it feel easily accessible to the whole UT community. Someone else says, I think BELO on campus exemplifies many human factors. Right when you walk in, there's a little coffee shop and table space to work, while upstairs you can look over the balcony and see everything below, making this place less stressful. The high ceilings and openness of the building make it very user-friendly. So then a couple not at UT. Somebody says, The local library in my town is extremely effective in creating spaces for collaboration and community. The many study spaces spread throughout the building allow people to easily navigate the building and find who or what they're searching for with little trouble, yet allows for relatively quiet study alongside louder and more community-oriented spaces. Finally, Central Park is a space that is extremely holistic in terms of human factors. First of all, it provides a natural element of relief in an urban city. It's more intimate and private and calm than the busy, bustling city of New York. There are a lot of human activities, always things going on, and a humanizing presence. But the most interesting thing to me is how quiet it is. Despite all the human activity, it's very serene and calm. One of the things that just blows me away in this class is the difference between Twitter card responses at the beginning of the semester and Twitter card responses at the end of the semester. Those were extremely perceptive, really great examples, really clear kind of understanding of, well, what is the effect this physical environment is having on my ability as a student here at UT to be successful, to work with colleagues, to learn collaboration skills, to have a sense of community, to, you know, all of those things that are super important for the success of UT. And I'm really delighted that virtually every one of those buildings listed is a relatively new building at UT. And I would say that UT has, in the last 10, 12 years, done a phenomenal job of upping the ante on their human factors in their buildings. You can look at RLM, you know, some of those in engineering, totally suck. Oh my God, they suck. And, you know, it just does not encourage the kind of life on this campus that is nurturing for students. And then some of these others that have come later, CLA, Gatesdale, BELO, these are all within the last 5 years. And UT has gotten it. They've figured it out. And that's a really, really positive thing from my point of view in the direction this university's going. Okay, so today we're going to talk about, and really today and on Tuesday, we're looking kind of synoptically. How do we bring together the myriad of things we've been talking about? So on issues of form, we've been talking about color, texture, light, shape, space, proportion, balance, symmetry, all of those elements of form. We talked about sources of form in nature and organisms. We talked about sources of form in mathematics and geometry. So we had all of these different things that might provoke architectural form. And then when we talked about physical considerations, then there's this other myriad of issues there. Geography, topography, and ecology, things that have to do with water management and prevention of flooding, sustainability, energy efficiency, climate response, structure of buildings, what makes them stand up, what materials are appropriate, how they work structurally, construction, all of those kinds of issues, definitely important things for an architect to consider. And then in the third segment of the course, all these human factors about behavior and activities and function and meaning and communication and humanism and a whole other range of issues. And in a way, you got to kind of think, wow, you're supposed to be juggling all those things when you design a building? Like, you're supposed to be thinking of all that shit all at once when you're designing a building? And in fact, it is kind of daunting and confusing. So Alvar Aalto, who we've looked at a good bit, he said one time in his maturity, he said, when I start to approach an architectural problem, the first thing I do is I research the hell out of it. All of that stuff that we've just been talking about. You learn as much as you can about the economics of the situation, about the site, about the city you're working in, about the human factors, about the physical considerations, about issues of form, about materials, about, you know, you learn as much as you can about all of those things. And then he said, I always get a 3 o'clock in the morning feeling So you know when you stayed up really, really late, and at 3 o'clock in the morning, your brain doesn't quite function. You're tired. You can't quite put things together. It's just overwhelming and a little confusing. So Alvar Aalto, this great architect, when he's like 50 years old in his mature career, he says, every time I approach an architectural problem, after I do all that research, I get a 3 o'clock in the morning feeling. This is daunting. This is overwhelming. How do I deal with this? So it's inherent in the nature of the problem that this is an overwhelming amount of material and data and demand that you're trying to deal with in a building. So how do architects deal with that? And as a first premise, I want us to look at a quotation from a very, very well-known architect in the middle of the 20th century named Paul Rudolph. Paul Rudolph was probably the most prolific American architect of his generation. He was dean of the School of Architecture at Yale, a very, very successful guy. And this is what he said about architecture in the 20th century. He said, "In architecture, all problems can never be solved. Indeed, it's a characteristic of our time that architects are highly selective in determining which problems they want to solve. Great architects make wonderful buildings only because they ignore many aspects of a building. If we solve more problems, our buildings would be far less potent." So he's making the argument that the only way to deal with this myriad of problems is that you have to select which pieces of that you want to solve. And then you've got to ignore many aspects of the building. And that's a kind of logical way to approach this. And in many ways, that signal of a 20th century idea intellectually in a larger sense. So you could see that, in science, in the 20th century, we were constantly trying to find the answer to some of these big scientific questions. Albert Einstein wanted to find a general field theory that would explain everything from the cosmos down to the tiniest little molecular structure. He thought that there was a general field theory of physics that would explain all those things and fit them into a completely perfect pattern. And he worked, he discovered the theory of relativity when he was in his early 30s. He worked the rest of his career on a general field theory. He never found one, and probably most scientists would say now there is none. But in the 20th century, you're trying to find perfection. And so maybe you ignore the static, the things that seem to get in the way, and you say, okay, we're gonna assume that's not there, and we're gonna find this perfect, perfect theory. And that was all over in science. And that was also in political theory. So it was an era when, there were people trying to do pure socialism. If we could just get this pure version of socialism, like Karl Marx imagined, that would be the ideal human condition. Or there are other people saying, no, we need pure capitalism, unfettered capitalism, unregulated capitalism. And if we had that kind of capitalism, that would be the ultimate political success. Or the ultimate libertarianism, or objectivism, or all of these other political theories. So in politics, again, they were trying to ignore the static or the confused side of things and trying to find this perfect, clear solution. And that was happening in fields in the arts as well, in painting. There were artists who said, I'm just concentrating on the nature of paint and how I put the paint on the canvas. So you get sort of splatter paint and, people really experimenting with just that one aspect of painting, how I put paint on the canvas. Or in music, you get someone like John Cage, who made a composition that was all rests. No notes, all rest. So it's 20 minutes of silence. I'm going to explore what the rest is about in music. And so you have a performance of all rest, just silence. And that's taking one little part of music and concentrating on that. So in the 20th century, that's a kind of notion that's interesting to people. And that was very interesting to a lot of architects. And they said, okay, I don't have to solve all the problems. I'm just going to solve a few problems, and I'm going to solve them really well, amazingly well. And that's going to make extremely potent buildings, and I'm going to ignore many aspects of the building, and that's going to help me get this kind of potency. So it's an argument for things that are intense, and they're powerful, but they ignore many aspects of a building. So we're going to look for a little while here on how that attitude plays out and what kind of architecture that might produce. And then actually on Thursday, we're going to look a little different and maybe another way to think about this. But and this is one of the few lectures all semester where I get a little bitchy. Well, maybe I do occasionally in some of the other lectures, but this one is, maybe there's some real problems in this. So let's see what problems arise when you ignore some aspects of a building. So at the beginning, we're going to look at some buildings that are very, very strong in form. And the architect decided, this is what's important to me. And I'm going to concentrate on this, and I'm going to make very, very powerful form. But perhaps along the way, they ignore some other aspects of the building. So this is the John Hancock Building in Boston. The architect is I.M. Pei. I.M. Pei was another one of those just, you know, kingpin architects of his generation. Very, very well-known American architect of Chinese descent. And when he was doing this building, he was at the peak of his career. Very famous architect doing a major, major building in downtown Boston. And the building is, it's a high-rise building, office building for the John Hancock Company, which is an insurance company. So it was the tallest building in Boston, is still the tallest building in Boston. It kind of sits isolated, so it's very, very prominent on the skyline of Boston. And they made it as a very long, skinny trapezoid. And it's absolutely stunning as a piece of minimalist art. So from anywhere you are in the central part of Boston, you see this building. And because it's this long, skinny trapezoid, sometimes you see it from the long side and it's very broad, and sometimes you see it from the narrow side and it's super skinny. And so it's a building that changes enormously. As you drive around on the freeways or you look from different angles, it's a shapeshifter. It's constantly got a different look to it. And it's made of this reflective blue glass that kind of takes on whatever characteristic the sky has. So some days it's just absolutely gorgeous blue, and you see every cloud or every element of the sky in it. And then on a gray day, it almost disappears. It just merges with the gray of the sky because it's about the same color. And so sometimes it's dazzling and shimmery and like the Emerald City or something. And then other days, it's kind of cold and solid. And so it's got this amazing chameleon quality to it. And it's certainly a striking building on the skyline. I got to say, I think it's a beautiful building. It has even this little detail on the skinny side where it has a little facet taken out of it, and that makes it seem even thinner at the end by making that little indentation, by changing that proportion to be even more vertical than it would be otherwise, making it seem taller than it would otherwise. But even that little shift changes the reflection somewhat. So I was living for 3 years in a building that was right across the Charles River from this building. And I was looking at that face of the building. My place was on the 14th floor of a building. So this beautiful view across the river of the John Hancock Building. And that little facet turns west. And so there would be some days, especially in the winter, it turns kind of southwest, when this side of the building, that side, would be facing the sky kind of where it was still blue. But this piece would be facing where the sunset was. And so you would see, like a thermometer, it would be brilliant orange at the bottom and then gradually getting blue at the top, and the rest of the field would be blue. And just that little shift, that little facet in there, made the reflections amazing when the sky would be changing. So it's a very engaging, very, very beautiful building. And if you're saying, I'm Ian Pei, and I'm going to choose what problems I want to solve, and I'm going to solve, it's a big, dominant building, people see it from all over, I'm going to solve the problem of its landmark visual quality, and I'm going to make it this stunning thing for people to see. And that sounds pretty legitimate, doesn't it? And then he says, okay, that's going to be the king. That's what I'm going to do 100%. And that's going to mean that I'm going to have to ignore some other aspects of the building. So there are a number of things that are not so great in the building. In particular, some things about human factors. So because it's such a long, skinny building, and high-rise buildings have to have tons of elevators. This one is really tall, so it has to have tons of elevators. So there's a huge elevator block that goes up in the middle of the building. And in the middle, it's so full of elevators, there's not much workspace in that middle of the building. So it kind of divides each floor into a pod at one end and a pod at the other end. And all these people, they're like insurance actuarials and people who work together in teams, and they have departments and they need to communicate with each other. But because each floor is relatively small, and then because it's divided into two different parts, it means that you really can't get these good team spaces, these good multidiscipline kind of departmental spaces. So it doesn't really work that well in terms of accommodating the workplace that's supposed to go on inside. And then also, so let's imagine your mom works on the 32nd floor of the John Hancock Building, and you're trying to imagine where your mom works. Well, to some extent, it doesn't look like anybody works in this building. It doesn't look like it's full of human beings doing interesting work at all. It just looks like an iceberg. And there's something kind of dehumanizing about the fact that there's no ability to identify floors or activity or anything that might go on in the building. It just seems like a big abstract piece of sculpture. And that's true in particular at the lower floor, where it just slams down into the city, just bang, and the scale is enormous. And there's really no kind of mitigating of that scale. It's a little harsh in that part of the city. And especially because it's right next to Trinity Church, which is this 19th century H.H. Richardson building. We've looked at buildings by him before. And it's got an amazing scale and texture. And so this other building seems very abstract, not very humanistic in that regard. Okay, so it's got some issues about human factors. But the big issues here are about physical considerations, which he did ignore some significant aspects of the building there. Obviously, for the sun, it's pretty much the same all the way around. So that long face that we're seeing in the slide on the left, that's south. And that would be a good orientation if there were some sun shading. But there's, of course, no sun shading. So that means that it just gets the glare of the sun all the time. And there is a heat gain issue in the building. But even more significant than that, it is kind of reflective glass. And so the sun shines on that south face, and then it reflects down to buildings below. And there's a whole neighborhood of buildings down there that just get fried in the summertime because the sun shines on the building, reflects down, and heats up
those buildings in that neighborhood. And the neighbors all got together and sued John Hancock because their air conditioning bills went through the roof. And so now John Hancock pays their energy bills in the summertime because the building was creating heat concentrations in neighborhoods nearby that were increasing their air conditioning bills. Not a good thing. Another physical considerations problem is, you can see in the slide on the left, it's right next to Trinity Church. Trinity Church is this venerable, historic building. Had been there 100 years at the time John Hancock was built. And it had been built on piles, on piers that went down into the ground as the foundation until it hit bedrock. This whole area of the Back Bay in Boston is crappy soils. It used to be a bay, and then they filled it in. And so if you want to get a good foundation, you have to go down deep, deep, deep. And so when they built Trinity Church, they made these deep wooden piles, big tree-sized wooden piles, that went down to the bedrock, and they're holding up Trinity Church. When they started to do the John Hancock building, they were again going to do this heroic foundation. So they start excavating down there. And when they excavate, the groundwater started to come in. Well, they couldn't excavate with the groundwater there, so they started pumping out the groundwater so that they could get a dry surface to excavate. And they pumped and pumped and pumped and pumped, and they started pumping all the groundwater out in this whole district. And so the groundwater lowered at Trinity Church across the street, and it exposed those wood piles for the first time they'd been exposed in 100 years. So as long as those wood piles were covered in water, they don't rot because there's no oxygen to make the chemical reaction of rotting process. But when they took the water away, they were suddenly exposed to oxygen, and the piles of Trinity Church began to rot. And so they were pumping away for months and months and months. There began to be rot that was happening in the piles of Trinity Church. There began to be settling in Trinity Church where the foundation was failing. There began to be cracking in those beautiful stone walls. And so the church gets very alarmed. They realize it's because they've been pumping the water out from under the building. And so again, there's a huge lawsuit against John Hancock to, you know, fix the structural problems that their building created across the street. And so, again, John Hancock is paying tons of money and, in fact, paid for a complete restoration of Trinity Church, top to bottom, because of the problems that they'd created with the foundation of the building. So you ignore some aspects of the building, some of these physical considerations. It causes some real problems, and it caused John Hancock not only expense but also embarrassment. But that was nothing compared to the third physical considerations problem. This building, because of its shape, is like a sail. And Boston is a super windy city. So the wind blows on that long face of the building. And of course, it's trying to push it this way, and it doesn't have much depth to resist that. So that little skinny shape in the other direction means it wants to go over like this. So that shape is a very bad structural shape for a tall building that's getting lots and lots of wind. It's about the worst structural shape you could get. And so as the wind hit it, it wanted to bend like this. It meant that the steel frame on one side of the building opened up as it closed up on the other side in bending. And it meant that all of those glass panes in the lower part of one side opened up and the glass popped out and fell down to the street. And so there was a period of time, it was during the time I was living in Boston, and you know, you could watch and a pane of glass would pop out and crash on the street. And they had to close off about a 5-block area all the way around the building because the sky was falling. You know, the building was falling. And so merchants had to close down their shops. Businesses had to shut down because you couldn't tell when the glass was going to fall from the sky. And so they replaced it with plywood panels and were scurrying around trying to figure out what the problem was. And it was for months and months and months. It looked like this for at least a year while they were trying to figure out what the problem was and figure out a way to address it. So in that period of time, I'm living in my apartment on the 14th floor across the river. I have a good friend who is graduating from MIT at the time. And this guy is from Cutoff, Louisiana. Really, really backwoods hick Louisiana. And so his dad is coming up for graduation. And his dad has like never been out of Cutoff, Louisiana. I mean, he is a Cajun hick. And so Russell is like, I don't know what to do with my dad while he's here. You know, let me bring him over to your apartment because you got a nice view. So I said, okay, bring your dad over. So his dad comes over and we have dinner. And so he's looking out the window and he says, I'm sure because you're an architect, you must really like living in Boston because they got the best architecture in Boston. And I'm thinking, well, yeah, Boston does have really cool architecture. And I'm, that's right, it does. And he said, you know, I tell you, you want to know what my favorite thing is that I've seen here in Boston, the very best architecture I've seen? He said, I really like that plywood skyscraper. I've never seen anything like that. And he's totally playing me, you know, suckered me. Because here was this city that's supposed to be very sophisticated compared to Cutoff, Louisiana, and they're doing the most dumbass, stupid thing you can possibly imagine, building this building that's falling down while you're building it. Incredibly embarrassing for John Hancock. They're an insurance company. They're supposed to be encouraging people to play it safe, you know, and not endanger people's lives and money. And here they are, their building is falling apart and throwing shards of glass all over the city. And it's incredibly visible and incredibly embarrassing. There were, of course, all kinds of lawsuits that came out of this. And IMPAI's office almost went completely bankrupt. It just ruined IMPAI. And because he ignored some aspects of the building. He concentrated on some things, and the ironic thing is exactly what makes this building so beautiful, that long, skinny shape, is exactly what created the downfall, because it acted as a sail and it became structurally stupid. So, can you ignore many aspects of a building? Can you ignore something like structure and construction and in order to get this sexy, beautiful form? Maybe not a great idea. A second building. This one is by an architect we've looked at many times, Lou Kahn. Incredible architect. We saw the Kimball Museum, which has just got to be one of the best buildings in the world, right here in Fort Worth, Texas. We saw Bryn Mawr Dorm that he did. We saw the buildings in Ahmedabad in India that he did. We've seen many buildings by Lou Kahn. And this is a building he did in Dhaka, Bangladesh. It's a short distance from the Sheri Banglanara, the capital of Bangladesh that we saw in an earlier lecture. But this one was done about the same time as the Capitol building. He was there in the country working on the Capitol building, and they were going to build a big hospital. And so they thought, well, let's use this renowned American architect while he's here. He can do our hospital as well. So it's hired to do that. And it's made out of the local brick, very prominent material in the area. And Lou Kahn said, I asked a brick what it wanted to be, and it said an arch. And so he used that logical, good, clear shape of the arch to make these not just arch shapes, but full circle shapes. And he kind of got And this is geometry. You know, we talked about geometry as a source of form. He uses those geometric shapes as very powerful objects on the front of this building and creates actually a really complex geometry, because it's not just the circles on the front and the kind of segments of circles within that making another kind of arch, but also after that front facade, then there is a perpendicular set of circles, and then there's a second parallel set of circles. And so you're seeing constantly circle on circle on circle, the geometry interacting with each other, making these interesting geometrical patterns, and a very, very sophisticated bit of form. And this was clearly an exercise Liu Kang loved. And in fact, to make that more prominent, he made these three porches that go through the building, a layer on the outside, a second porch here, which is that porch, and then a double-decker porch as a third layer. So you're constantly seeing through these circular and arched forms to the other, and the light quality, very interesting. So yes, in terms of geometry, in terms of light, in terms of material, color, shape, it's a really magnificent building. Now, one kind of sad thing is that this is a hospital. So they were expecting to have 900 beds in this hospital. But when he did the design, and he did the design for 900 beds, it had this three series of porches, and then it had the hospital part of it, 900 beds behind that. So you went through this entry sequence, and then you got to the area for the patients. But they didn't have enough money. The budget of the building was set from the beginning. And by the time you built these three magnificent porches, there was only enough money to build 300 beds for the patients. So they only built 300 beds instead of 900 beds. Now, this is a super poor country, really poor country. Healthcare is difficult to come by. So is it a responsible decision to say that we're going to, for the sake of form, make these three magnificent porches, and that's how we're going to spend our money, and because of that, we're not going to be able to have the beds that the hospital needed and wanted? So when I visited the building, there were patients everywhere. In every hall, there were patient beds. In these double-decker areas up here, which were meant to be, you know, overlooks, there were patient beds. They were just jammed in every single place they possibly could put them because they just did not have enough beds. And even then, they had to turn many, many, many people away, sick people who needed health care. Is it a responsible decision to ignore the human factors of function and necessity and the mission of a hospital in order to get this magnificent experience of form at the front door of the building? Another thing that seemed very important to Kahn is, in order to make this geometry very powerful, you couldn't have a lot of little normal-sized windows. So like patient rooms, exam rooms, operating rooms, offices for doctors, they would have these little windows. And that would just screw up the scale of this. You needed the magnificent monumental scale of those circles, and you needed to play off of it these sort of very solid masonry walls within maybe another big circle. And what happened here is then that creates a little courtyard, and you do get some normal-sized windows on that tiny little courtyard. But for large, large parts of the building, there are no windows. There are no windows because it's important to Kahn to have that blank surface to contrast with these big geometrical shapes. So for the sake of form, you want that wall blank. If you were thinking of function, it would be nice to have a window in that patient room. It would be nice to have a window in that doctor's office. It would be nice to have a window even in that operating room, given the fact that electricity is very unreliable in Bangladesh. They have blackouts all the time. So while I was there and I was touring the hospital and the people who were showing me around took me to the director's office, And we sit down in the director's office, and it is one of those windowless spaces. And that's fine, the lights are on. But then in the middle of the conversation, there was a power outage, and the lights went off. And the director of the hospital very calmly opened his drawer of his desk, pulled a candle out, struck a match, lit the candle, never missed a beat, never interrupted his sentence. It's just so routine to him to have to, you know, create candlelight to work by, because there's no freaking window in the room to let a little natural light in. I ask him what happens in the operating rooms. Well, we do have a problem with that, because it's very hard to operate by candlelight. You know? So is this a good decision? Now, form is important, and the form is emphasized here, and he's chosen what problems he wants to solve. He wants to solve the problem of form, but he ignores many aspects of the building, like getting enough hospital beds, like getting natural light so that you can work in a building when there is the inevitable power outage. So it has made a building that, in terms of actual function and human factors, has some terrible problems. It also has problems in terms of physical considerations. So I had seen this building published in the magazines when I made the trek over to Bangladesh. You know, I was really looking forward to seeing this building. I thought those, you know, those circles were just dynamite. But, you know, never any article I'd read about it, it never told you that that facade right there points west, due west. Bangladesh is right at the equator. It is hotter than hell in Bangladesh. If you think it's hot in Texas, you ain't seen nothing. It's hotter in Bangladesh. I was there in December, and even on a December day, it's really hot at noontime. And because that's west-facing, after about 1 or 2 in the afternoon, when the sun comes around to the west, the sun beats in those big openings all afternoon. And it shines on that high thermal mass brick wall, and it heats it up, and it retains all that heat, and it's just like a pizza oven. I mean, it is just really hot in that space. So even in December, by 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was no one in that space. It was too hot. You couldn't stand it. So even all that space, which is beautiful in a photograph, but in fact, thermally disastrous and a really unpleasant space to be in. So again, can you really choose what problems you want to solve and ignore many problems in a building? Is that really an appropriate way to behave? Okay, so that's a couple of examples. Let's have a third example in terms of form. Beautiful, interesting, amazing, incredible form. This is housing for low-income workers in La Défense in Paris. La Défense is a very chichi neighborhood on the western outskirts of Paris. If you go down the Champs-Élysées and you go past the Arc de Triomphe and you're going west out of the city, you go a long way out there and you hit La Défense. And it's a business center. And there's tons of high-rise buildings out there. There are no high-rise buildings particularly in the middle of Paris, but out on the outskirts at La Défense, it's a cluster of, now especially, huge high-rise buildings. And it's where rich people live, and it's where major corporations have their headquarters. It's a very, very affluent neighborhood. But the French are very liberal people, and they don't like the idea of everybody being separated into different social classes. So being good liberal people, they decide, well, we've got to have some people who are going to be the janitors and the custodians and the groundskeepers, you know, and instead of shipping them in from the poor part of the city, instead, we're going to build some low-income housing right here in La Défense, where they can live. So this is low-income housing in La Défense, and it's built by the government. And now, you don't want to look out your sleek, glassy corporate headquarters window and see this shabby, low-income housing. So they said, okay, well, we're going to hire a cool-ass architect, Emil Ayo, and we're going to ask him to do something that doesn't look dowdy or cheap or low-income. So they asked him to make some buildings that look cool in La Défense, but for low-income housing. So he does that, and he makes these amoeba-shaped buildings. They're about five towers that have these apartments in them. And they're definitely sleek and cool and hip and savvy. I mean, they were done in 1977. They still look kind of out there. And they look like they fit in La Défense. It's all, you know, upscale. They have ceramic tile on the outside of them, really glittery, shimmery stuff, and it's in these amazing patterns, almost like camouflage. And then the windows are all either circles or teardrops, or little kind of squares with the corners rounded off. But very, very interesting form. And I'll have to say, I find them just mesmerizing. You see them from different angles and in different combinations with each other, and they are definitely cool-looking buildings. Okay, so how about human factors? So, okay, most of the people who live here are North African. That's the ethnic group that they bring in for doing custodial jobs and groundskeepers and so on. So there are lots of these North African people who live in the buildings. And, you know, they have families and all of that. I don't know, there's something completely anachronistic about the people who are living in it and the look of the buildings. And definitely the area around the buildings, like here, it's all these sort of sculptural shapes in hardscape. Terrible. I mean, you can't imagine a kid playing. There's no grass. It's just really, sculpturally, it's powerful. But in terms of any kind of humanism at a larger scale, no periodic natural relief, no activities. It's just this kind of barren land with these big dominant skyscrapers coming out of it. Then actually inside, and I did not have the nerve to take photographs inside these people's houses, but you know, you've got amoeba shapes. You've got tiny little rooms because it's low-income housing. So they can't have a huge bedroom. They have a tiny little bedroom. You have a tiny little amoeba-shaped bedroom, and they've got normal furniture. They can't have custom, you know, hip round beds or something like that. They got a rectangular bed, and they're putting it in this room, and there's not a flat wall to put your bed against. So you go in there in somebody's bedroom, the bed is sitting in the middle of the room, and there's just kind of enough room to walk around it, but they can't figure out, how do you even inhabit this room? How do I even put my furniture in here? How do I get my sofa, you know, in the living room? All the walls are curved, so there's like a gap between my sofa and the back, and nothing works efficiently. So it's inhabited very, very poorly on the inside. And then in terms of physical considerations, well, of course, you know, no orientation to sun. Really, the windows are tiny. They would have spectacular views. They could have some really good thermal warming because it's kind of a northern climate there, but the windows don't do that at all. They're just these tiny little portholes. So it's tiny dark rooms with tiny little porthole windows. And then of course, because some of them are shaped like teardrops, it's completely custom. So if there's ever a broken window and the windows don't have frames, they're just like you can see here, it's just a single sheet of glass. And so they're very easy to break. And there were a lot of windows that were broken when I was there, so and it's really hard to find a replacement. So it was expensive to build, and then it's expensive to maintain and replace. And then look at these poor people in that slide on the right. How do you put curtains on this window? It tilts, pivots like that, and it's this odd shape. So you can see somebody has just kind of put a sheet up on that wall to try to give themselves a little bit of privacy, because they haven't taken care of the physical considerations of how you close the window, open the window, get light, get privacy. Those things are just not dealt with. Those aspects of the building were ignored. So in terms of human factors and physical considerations, huge, huge problems in this building. Okay, so you can say, that's just those dumbass architects. You're always interested in the way the building looks, but not paying attention to these other functional and technical things. But I would say there are architects who also choose to deal with functional aspects of the building and ignore some other aspects. An example of that might be the history faculty in Cambridge that we looked at when we were looking at human factors. And we looked at how absolutely beautifully this building deals with the functions of a library and the functions of this history faculty, where all of the faculty offices are around this major atrium space, and the library is the very heart of the complex, and all the more public rooms like the lecture halls and so on are at the bottom, and then the seminar rooms, and up at the top the offices. I mean, in terms of function and where everything's located, this building is superb, and it works really, really well. And people like all those arrangements of where everything is, where the books are in the book stacks, where the reading room is, where the circulation desk is. All of that just works beautifully. But this building has its problems in other regards. Certainly in terms of physical considerations, it's got some terrible problems. All that glass, for one thing, very, very difficult to keep it clean. So it's just perpetually dirty. They do have a little gantry here that's meant to be a way to clean that angled glass, but it has not worked very well, and so it's just a perpetual problem of the thing just looks dirty all the time. Another thing is, of course, there's tons and tons of light that comes in that central space, which would be kind of okay because it's a northern climate in England, but they didn't take into account the fact that that light and the heat that you get from it, which is fine in that climate, also has ultraviolet light. And ultraviolet light is terrible for books. It deteriorates paper very quickly, and it deteriorates the glue in the binding very quickly. So if you have lots of natural light and a lot of ultraviolet, like maybe sometime you checked out a book from the library and you put it in the back of your car, you know, behind the back seat, and you leave it there for a couple of weeks, it'll just wreck that book. The paper all gets crumbly and the glue all gets flaky. It just destroys books, ultraviolet light. So here's a library with lots of books and tons of ultraviolet light. And a lot of these books were very valuable books, irreplaceable books. And after they moved into the building and they were there for a little while, they realized their books are really deteriorating. And this is a terrible physical considerations problem. Too much ultraviolet light on those books. The other thing is, unfortunately, all that skylight leaked. So there also was moisture that was coming in. Another thing that books really do not like is moisture. So the moisture, the ultraviolet light, were really deteriorating the books. They had to actually take all the books out of the library, put them somewhere else, store them somewhere else. For a while, the whole library was shut down. Oh my God. Just did not think of those physical considerations. Ignored those aspects of the building. This is a picture on the left when they just evacuated the library because the physical considerations weren't dealt with. Then in terms of form, you know, I actually think it's kind of a handsome building. It looks like a kind of machine for history in the abstract. But if you're there and you're on the Cambridge campus, the Cambridge campus looks like the slide on the left, and the building is definitely strange and anachronistic in the context of the Cambridge campus, and there are many, many people. It's been around a long time now. It's not like people warmed up to it. They still think it looks like it came from Mars, and just not a good form solution in that context. Okay, so here's another building that was super amazing in terms of human factors. So this is done by an architect named Lucian Kroll. And Lucian Kroll has a very, very bizarre attitude about his role as an architect. He believes architects should be like lawyers. They should be advocates. And if you're a lawyer and somebody comes to you and says, I'm being accused of murder and I need you to defend me, now you might actually think this jerk is a murderer, but you don't have the right to go up in court and say, my client's a freaking murderer. You have to defend him. You have to be his advocate. That's the ethical thing to do as a lawyer. And Lucian Kroll thinks that's true of architects too. If your client wants something, that's God. That's how things ought to be. And you should always just listen to the client. So he's doing this medical faculty at the University of Louvain in Brussels, Belgium, and he sincerely listens to everyone who is the client, listens to the students, listens to the faculty, listens to the staff. You know, you've got this laboratory, how do you want your laboratory? You've got this, there was housing built into this faculty. How do you want your housing? What do you want it to feel like? What do you want it to look like? He just asked everybody, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want? And then he made an environment that reflected everybody's different wants. So if you wanted space-age zoomy, you got space-age zoomy. If your neighbor wanted, you know, really charming old brick and wood, they got really charming old brick and wood. And the building became this just agglomeration of everybody's wants. And in fact, everyone felt very empowered. The architects listened to me. I can see my desires incorporated in the building. So in a certain way, in terms of human factors, it was very successful. In terms of physical considerations, it was a horror to build. Tons of crazy joints between materials that never were meant to go together. Leaked like a sieve from day one. Has been very, very difficult to maintain. It has no particular thermal advantage. There may be huge glass walls right next to, you know, walls with smaller, tiny windows. It's just because that's, he just gave people what they wanted. It didn't matter what the orientation was. So it doesn't work very well thermally. It didn't work very well in terms of construction or structure or materials. In terms of form, I don't know. Judge for yourself. I heard one person described that the very best thing about that building is to live inside it so you don't have to look at it. Because most people on that campus think that is the most butt ugly building they've ever seen. And it certainly is. It's chaotic, that's for sure. So sometimes you can emphasize human factors to the detriment of physical considerations or form. Here's another building, very strong, this time in terms of physical considerations. This building is an experimental structure. It was done by Eero Saarinen. We've looked at Saarinen's work through the semester. Very technologically savvy architect. He's experimenting here with thin shell concrete. He's trying to get the very most efficient use of concrete he can get. And so this dome is, of course, a really efficient use of concrete, this masonry material. And in fact, this one is only 4 inches thick at the top of that dome. And then it progressively gets thicker and thicker and thicker as the loads accumulate. And at the bottom, where it hits the ground, it's 17 inches thick right there. It is the maximum span for the minimum amount of material and the perfect shape for getting that structural performance. And in that way, super efficient, really, really carefully done technological innovation. So you got to give it credit on physical considerations. Now, unfortunately, in terms of form, it kind of looks like a spaceship landed. It's not very welcoming. It's not very approachable. It's an odd ball just sitting out there. But I don't know, maybe not terrible in terms of form. In terms of physical consideration, I mean, in terms of human factors, yeah, really, really problematic. So this is Boston. That's that wall we're seeing right here. where you enter into the lobby of the building. Just any building in Boston has what they call airlocks, which means you go through one set of doors, there's a little vestibule, you go through another set of doors. That's so you don't get the cold air blowing in when somebody opens the door, because presumably at least that first door shuts a little bit before they open the second door. No airlocks on this, so functionally, very difficult to ever get that room comfortable. In the wintertime, it's just freezing, and everybody's in. When you go out to the lobby for intermission, you have to put on your big heavy coat again because it's freezing in that lobby. Not comfortable for human beings at all. But the real killer here is acoustics and the sound and people's, and the just function of the building, which was meant to be a performance space. It was supposed to be able to have theater performance, musical performance, as well as lectures. But Saarinen, because he got this idea of the dome, he then thought, well, you know, if we're going to have theater performances, most theater performances would have a fly loft, one of those big, tall spaces where you, the scenery goes up and the scenery goes down. You kind of need that for theater performances. And they expected they would get that in their performing arts building. But Saarinen convinced them at a certain point that we don't really need a fly loft over the stage over here, that instead we're going to have extremely innovative theater, and people aren't going to use scenery. They're just going to use lighting and kind of abstract things. And so really modern theater is going a different direction, and we're not going to need fly lofts anymore. So he convinced them. He was a silver-tongued bastard, but he convinced them they didn't need a fly loft. And of course, the fly loft would have wrecked the dome shape. So they got no fly loft. So then no traveling troops, no sophisticated theater group could use it. So there are not very many performances in the space. Also, the stage is at one of those sort of triangular culminations of the building. And there wasn't really room for all the dressing rooms on the floor by the stage, which, of course, is where you want the dressing. People are trying to change costumes, you know. You want them to do that efficiently. So he put actually all the dressing rooms and green rooms are on the floor below, kind of in the basement. So people are always walking down the stairs to change their costume and then walking back up the stairs. And so that doesn't really work for theater performances. But the real killer is, if you try to have a musical performance in here, it does not work at all. It just doesn't function at all. So this my acoustics professor took us all here. He loved to do a field trip to Kresge Auditorium so he could show us how not to do acoustics. So it's a dome, right? And acoustically, a dome concentrates the sound. It's, you know, the angle of incidence equals the angle of reflection. So if a sound happens, it goes up and it comes back down. And if it's shape, if it's reflecting from a dome, it's going to concentrate that sound. So in fact, it does that really beautifully. If you stand right there or you sit in a seat right there, if you stand there and you stomp on the ground like that, it will go bang, 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 bang. Because all that sound is going out, back, out, back, out, back, out, back, out, back, until it dissipates. So that's kind of the problem in all of these. When you concentrate on one or a few aspects of the building and you ignore other aspects of the building, you leave yourself vulnerable to these failures. Now, I want, as your Twitter card question, I want you to be skeptical of what I just said. Is there a redeeming value in concentrating on one or a few aspects of the building? Or where do you come down on this? Is that intolerable? Are you angry? Or do you kind of see what they're doing there and that could be okay? When you look around to other buildings in your environment, do you sometimes see this happening? Is this a problem where architects ignore some aspects of a building? And what are the consequences of that? So give me a Twitter card response on that.